This is the December 12 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our panelists for the day include Matt Bennett. He's of agmarket.net out of Windsor, Illinois. Elaine Cubb joins us from Ipswich, South Dakota. Mike Zuzlo is here. He's from Atchison, Kansas and globalanalytics.biz. And J.P. Jones joins us for the first time ever. J.P. is at the F.C. Stone office right here in Champaign, Illinois. Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. You can find it online at willag.org. WILLAG.ORG. JP, let's start with you, and then we'll get a list of items that maybe we should discuss. But I'd kind of like to know a little bit about yourself and the office here in Champaign that belongs to INTL FC Stone.
Sure. My name is JP Jones, as you mentioned, and I am with INTL FC Stone as a risk management consultant. Work focused on commercial elevators, primarily in the area of OTC, and then also focus on producer marketing and working with producers as they put together marketing strategies for each crop year.
How long have you been doing this?
I've been with FC Stone for about 3 years now. And before that, I was with Cargill.
For how long?
Put me on the spot. I believe 3 or 4 years with Cargill.
Fantastic. Anything you want to talk about for sure today?
Obviously, the conversation today is around tariff and whether or not we have a phase one agreement. So I think that's what everybody has been focused on. And then maybe the USMCA, the impact of that, I think are two things I would throw out this afternoon.
Elaine Cubb, how are things going in South Dakota?
Well, slowly, and that's the thing I think that probably the topic I think we should talk about, I'm sure it's been covered by you already this week, is the slow harvest progress in the eastern Dakotas, including North Dakota. But it's not just slow harvest progress. I mean, I think there's implications for certainly the cash corn market, for what it means to have high moisture corn, low test weight corn, and the stuff coming in late and coming in maybe not in time for the grain stocks report.
Matt Bennett, anything from you that we ought to have on our list today?
They pretty much covered the main things. You know, for me, I think that to further expand on what Elaine said, you know, just what usage is going to look like on down the road with some of this low test weight corn. I think that that's a story that's going to take some time to unfold. But by all means, I think that it's going to rear its head here later on in 2020. Hopefully, we'll find out, by the June quarterly stocks report. Maybe we'll learn a little bit in March. But I do think that's something that's going to be something that you certainly don't want to go to sleep on.
And Mike Zuzlo.
Just the USDA report and the talk around USMCA and impeachment, those things seem to be pretty key things to tap into from a perspective of both the short-term and long-term, Todd, if you ask me.
Well, let's start with the USDA report. It was a quiet one. What'd you see there?
Well, it was quiet in the domestic side, and the extra crop progress reports USDA gave us, and something that Elaine can go into probably more detail on since she's in that neighborhood, continued to show a vast majority of corn unharvested and real tragic issues in some farmers' backyards and clients that I work with. But the world numbers were much, much different. And USDA came in and said, look, the National Bureau of Statistics saw an increase in wheat and corn production. We're just going to run those numbers right through the statistics. And I did a write-up after the report and looked at not just USDA analysis from August when a PCAD report and an FAS report they put out about China's crop and the larger bean acreage, smaller corn acreage, but then went ahead and looked at some key provinces on their year-to-date moisture and three-month moisture levels. And about 33% of the corn production areas in China had less than last year's rainfall cumulative, but yet we are somehow at 260 million tons. for Chinese production instead of 257 last year. So I really call into question the USDA's movement on that and taking the NBS numbers at face value, especially given what we're dealing with here domestically and given what other countries are dealing with as well. I think they need to step it up and be a little bit more forward-looking, or at least scrutinize the data a little bit more closely.
You'll have to forgive me, but don't they do minus China as well, so they just take the Chinese numbers and then they subtract them out and don't worry about them?
They do that, and I think that's where the trade, once we, you know, USMCA was kind of like a perfect storm, if you ask me. Why did we go down yesterday and on Wednesday, I should say, why did we go down so hard and break down through some technical support levels? And I think it was USDA report followed by USMCA and the Senate not being brought up until after impeachment, and why Senator McConnell did that and whether that would change the dynamic of how the Chinese negotiated with us. But it is a very stark difference when you look at the minus China number for corn versus the including China number for corn. And I think the trade's going to have to, if we get these trade deals worked out, both USMCA and the December 15 tariffs don't go into effect, I think the trade's going to have to swing back around and say, these corn prices are too cheap.
Elaine Cupp, you mentioned the problems that have taken place in the Western Corn Belt, and particularly in the Dakotas. They have been all season long for them. Here in the Eastern Corn Belt, the corn mostly got out. If you go far enough north, as clearly it did not, but there's an awful, awful lot of corn in North Dakota, and it's gotten cold there as well. Can you tell me about conditions on the ground? And I know you're in Ipswich in South Dakota, but what it's like today and what your expectations are?
Why, yes, I can tell you. So the crop progress report showed South Dakota 83% harvested on Sunday, and it is still going on here. You know, a foot of snow isn't going to stop a combine in eastern South Dakota or eastern North Dakota. So figure South Dakota's still got 15% left to do, but North Dakota still has more than half because it's not the snow and it's not even the cold. In fact, the cold weather may be helpful in some instances by freezing up the ground. In North Dakota, and I was just up there, I drove up and back the full north to south length of North Dakota last week on my way to a canola conference. Anyway, so it's through eastern North Dakota, which is basically all corn. I mean, if folks haven't been there, think of like southern Iowa, where there is still some cattle, but you're looking at mostly entirely corn fields. Not a lot of wheat stubble, not a lot of canola stubble through most of that. Some soybeans that were still standing, but all of that standing corn is just extremely grim. And like I said, the problems going forward is not even the snow. It's the low test weight. My understanding is that the farmers aren't harvesting that corn because they have no place to go with it. The elevators will not accept that corn because it's an entire region-wide problem, and an entire elevator is then full of number three or number four corn that they cannot then fill their contracts. It's not deliverable. So that's really where they're stuck at. And like I mentioned, it's not just a Dakota's problem. Here in South Dakota, there's enough higher test weight corn that the elevators are still taking the low test weight corn and are therefore able to blend it. And that's probably the case where you're at or throughout most of the rest of the Corn Belt, is if you don't have an entire region, you have enough that you can mix and blend that this will work. Michigan, Wisconsin. So this isn't really a November or December weather problem. This was a, you know, August, September weather problem where we just didn't have enough heat units to get those kernels finished off at a high enough test weight. So like Matt mentioned, this is going to be an issue that the cash market is going to deal with for months and months while you try to get a bid for a number three train, or while the feed industry tries to figure out how they can use these total digestible nutrients that are still there in the corn, but they can buy it at a discount. They've just perhaps got to truck it in strange directions, or anybody who's got a grain dealer's license and has an ability to buy some of this cheap low test weight corn now has that opportunity to do the mix and blend, make that arbitrage. And there will be some profits really made from this scenario, but those profits are certainly not being made by the farmers being discounted and not by the elevators that are stuck in an entire region full of that low test weight.
Yeah, just to be clear on this, this is not a new problem this week, that this problem has existed since the, October 15 freeze. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, sure, but you wouldn't really know. I think for a long time, the expectation was that we could leave the corn out in the field long enough and it would dry down enough. And so nobody really got in there to figure out what the test weights would be until you actually go and try and harvest it at 20% moisture or whatever. So yeah, getting the trade situated so that they know what's out there, that is a long and evolving process.
Yeah, I said October 15th, that may be October 12th. I can't remember when that snowstorm rolled through, but it was on time, relatively speaking, or at least the cold temperatures. I think the snow was more than expected. So maybe, J.P. Jones, since you deal with elevators, and I don't know how widespread your elevator background might be across geographic space, that is, but maybe you can tell me a little bit about how, if you know, how elevators have to deal with this and what you've been talking to them about.
Well, yeah, I mean, we don't have any elevators out in that specific area in terms of within the Champaign office. But it is definitely something that is being talked about. And to some degree, it's really isolating that entire region to try and, you know, figure out what alternatives do they have and how long are they going to be kind of mired in that space with this corn that, you know, for all intents and purposes, doesn't really meet well with, you know, corn that would otherwise be blown to docks.
Yeah, I have a question actually specifically. You mentioned doing the OTC stuff. If you had an entire elevator that was full of number three corn or number four corn, can you hedge that? I mean, is that can you hedge that just with corn futures, or is it not deliverable and then your hedge falls apart?
I don't know exactly how they would go about that. You know, obviously it doesn't meet the contract spec, and so I don't know how that would get navigated.
Anybody else know the answer? Matt, do you know the answer to that question?
No, I really don't. I don't. I think that, you know, Elaine's probably onto something there. You know, that would be really tough. I mean, from a deliverable standpoint, I don't know what the backing would be.
My suspicion would be you'd just have a lot more basis risk because there is a bid for number three shuttles to the PNW, and it's at some discount, right? I don't know what it is today. So I assume that's just an extra level of risk, you know, that's just a different basis risk that's on top of your already, you know, just regional basis risk.
I guess I wasn't thinking that it would be going to the PNW. I thought that stuff would all have to be into St. Louis so it could be blended off.
Well, the train patterns here, so this Western corn goes by rail to the PNW, but it should. I mean, if we can find a truck route or rail rates don't really exist right now to move it east, but if you had those rail rates to move it east where it could be blended or put into the feed sector, that would be great.
Okay, so let's talk about where this corn actually has to go and what it means to be bases across the Corn Belt. So I'm going to make a leap of faith that bases isn't horrible, actually, where you are. In South Dakota, probably in North Dakota, but the discounts are really rough when you bring this in, right? First, is that correct?
That is correct. The basis here is stronger than usual for this time of year, which is, you know, exactly on par with nationwide, where you've got it stronger than usual for this time of year. But yeah, by the time you get a check cut to a farmer, it's been taken out in discounts for sure and drying fees.
Yeah, so either it has to go out the PNW and they have to figure out what to do with it, or it has to find a new route coming back this way. So does anybody have any experience or thought on what they think that much corn coming east will do to the marketplace and what they'll be hunting for at this point? Matt?
That's a tough question. I mean, you know, it's a little bit different than what we've been used to, for sure. But I don't know. I mean, for me, you know, I've got to ask, you know, looking at basis, for instance, today, I looked at Hereford, Texas, they were talking a dollar over. And then you get up into Canada and there's areas that are $1.20 over. Obviously, those are corn deficit areas. But, you know, I would think basis is going to end up doing, continuing, trying to get the corn where it needs to go. But at the same time, you know, here lately, what I've seen, which has been very frustrating, I guess, is the bean market rallied here recently and the corn market sat around and did nothing, is that our basis did not, locally anyway, it just really didn't adjust. And so, you know, I guess, I think the base is going to have to do the work to get the corn where it needs to go. But at the same time, I think it's going to be a monumental task talking about the kind of bushels that you're asking about right now. I mean, it's just a much bigger, issue than what we're used to.
So the question really is, and farmers will, I know they've got to be asking you this question, why is the price of corn not higher than it is the futures contracts? Does anybody have a good answer for them?
My answer.
We've got answers that they're happy with, but yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So we'll get to the not happy answer here in a second. But Mike, what's your answer?
Well, my answer is the trade continues to be stuck, and this taps into what Matt was talking about. The trade keeps talking into its own mind the idea that because bean demand is recovered because of China purchasing, buy beans and sell corn is back on the list for how funds act. And USDA hasn't done anything except maybe in the last one or two reports to really change that dynamic. But the most important thing funds are doing right now is looking at demand, and they equate USMCA with corn demand and to a lesser degree, wheat demand and obviously ethanol demand to Canada. And then they equate the U.S.-China trade negotiations as it's not hurting us right now in the soybeans, but it is hurting us when it comes to pork. And I think you've got these trade features just flat out working the funds into a demand mindset that it's going to, let's buy soybeans and sell corn, let's buy cattle and sell hogs until we're told that the trade deals are made, and then we'll reevaluate and reflect on it. I think that's what this week showed us after the USDA report, was when Mitch McConnell said nothing coming until impeachment's over with. You saw a real change in dynamic of how the market acted on the Globex trade and how it, Tuesday night, and how it acted on Wednesday's trade and blew through some of those technical support levels.
Yeah, and McConnell is hoping, I think, to get this done quickly in January, but it won't be done till January. The president probably wants a much longer version of the impeachment in January, so it could be a while. Matt Bennett, you had an answer, but not one farmers may like. What is it?
Well, you know, I think recently, you know, you got to sit around here and ask yourself what's kept the corn market kind of held down. You know, I think a lot of folks come into the fall think, hey, you know, there's 1.5 billion bushels at one time. Now we're down to what, 1.2 billion bushels out in the field still for estimates. And people feel like, well, that's got to be friendly because there's going to be field loss. There's certainly going to be, I guess, a smaller crop in the long run. And then I think those of us who understand the test weight situation would argue as well that usage is going to be stronger with lower test rate corn, just because you're going to have to go through more of it. Well, you know, so you ask your question, how's come the corn market isn't doing anything? And, you know, the demand as far as the export side of it has just been pretty pathetic over the last multiple weeks. And I think that you know, ethanol, yes, you're able to boil through more corn for the 11th week in a row, you know, in the grinding of ethanol, but at the same time, you're seeing ethanol stocks ballooning. And so I think that from a demand perspective, you know, you're just having a really hard time getting the market going. And so I don't think there's enough of a supply situation yet to really get someone who might be interested in owning corn, I guess, to go ahead and make that step to own corn. It's just been a desolate market. And until you get some sort of a trade deal that maybe, you know, you get USMCA passed, and then if this phase one of the trade deal includes maybe some ethanol DDGs, like a lot of us have thought, that certainly would be a real boon to this corn market.
J.P. Jones, what have you been telling the elevators and or farmers about the situation?
Well, I think both of these guys hit it right on the head that I think the funds don't yet believe that there is a supply problem, and I think the producers don't yet believe that there is a demand problem. And so you have these two different sides just kind of hoping and waiting and expecting. And, you know, fortunately, I think in some ways this fall we've been fortunate that we have seen some basis strength. And I know elevators were able to buy higher percentage of bushels this year on basis contracts than they have in the past. But I'm curious as to see kind of where we go from here now that we are starting to see, hopefully, these agreements be reached and ultimately signed. Maybe we do start to see one side gain more of an advantage and we see a movement in value. But I think the trade side has been, until we see the USDA verifying that there's going to be a shortage, we're not ready to be bullish corn.
Do you think that they'll find that shortage in the January crop production report?
I mean, that's a great question. I mean, I think with the issues in North Dakota and South Dakota, I would like to think the USDA would start to address those by January, but trying to predict what the USDA is going to put into any particular report has felt extra crazy this year to me.
Well, they have said that for the grain stocks report that they will count anything that's in the field as in the bin or on farm. I suppose they could adjust yield, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, the question is, will they when it comes to the test weight? You know, is that going to get figured into the equation with the low test weights? Is field loss going to get figured in? You know, are they just going to take a standard number and go, well, acres are out there, so we know it's going to be this. Don't worry about it.
I don't know. That seems unlikely to me, I guess, from what I know about USDA. But they'll be surveying farmers on what the farmers say about their yields. I would think, well, maybe they won't know. Will farmers in the Dakotas know what that yield looks like?
No. No, I mean, it hasn't been harvested yet, so nobody knows. But I will say this. So in 2009, there was low test weight scenario, right, even in the central Corn Belt. And USDA went out and did their usual grain stocks thing and audited how many bushels are in a bin as volume. So the first few grain stocks reports reported volume of grain. And then it wasn't until months later that they went in and adjusted for the weight, the actual value, you know, feed value or matter value, the weight of that corn. So I personally wouldn't hitch my star to the idea that they're going to get this January grain stocks report totally correct. I suspect it will take some time.
Because they can't. I mean,
right.
because if the survey in the grain stocks numbers.
If we go back to 2009 crop, what you found is that June quarterly stocks report is where we finally got some truing up because of the test weight. What we found is that we burnt through way more corn, or the corn just simply wasn't there, depending on how you wanted to look at it. And I believe it was pushing a half a billion bushels, if you go back and look. It was a significant amount, and that really shocked the market. It was I remember that very well.
All right, so let's, now I think I've got some place to go. I was I've been searching along. I think I've got two things I want to know about. An awful lot of producers will have a basis contract with March futures, so we need to deal with that and how they go about setting a final price off that March contract, and then I need to probably know how to get a good portion or some of what they've got on farm storage all the way to June or July to take advantage of what might end up being a short crop. Does that make sense to you, Mike Zuzlow?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I think it's very important at this stage, from what I can see, Todd, do not, in my opinion, generally speaking, write a basis contract past that March, because if we're as tight and as short as we are, you may be on the wrong side of the market, and the futures market may not be willing to go ahead and give you any more up because maybe the weather's turning around, whatever it may be. The futures market is not giving you the up that you need, and then all of a sudden the cash market's realizing how tight they're going to be until we get the next harvest in. And so
and we'll have 94 million acres of corn.
Or 100, you know, let's go 100. Heck, let's just go crazy and go 100. And I do believe that. I think that's a real serious concern. I my general rule of thumb is if I write a basis contract and make that recommendation for a producer, I don't want to take that and roll it, and I really don't like taking that longer than 45 days. So my natural answer would be if I did a basis contract 2 weeks ago on March, which this last week, 2 weeks ago, I have been doing those and recommending those with specific areas, then I'm going to target 395 March corn. If we can close above that after the January report, then I'll be looking at about 4.25 on the March to really unload and really make hay while the sun's shining.
You know, I think I you know, whenever you look at, I mean, I'm pretty similar to Mike here. If I'm in a situation now, as far as these bin bushels go, you know, I've had a lot of folks that have asked me, should I just go ahead and empty bins or at least portions of my bins to take care of the really good basis? But the thing you got to ask yourself is, what if this market just stays dead as a doornail? You know, do you want to put all your eggs in that basket? Because you know, if basis ends up getting super hot, then there's no question that you're going to be pretty frustrated if you've locked the basis in and done nothing, you know, and not left yourself with the leverage. So what I see is that the ownership of corn in the bin for a producer at home is a heck of a leverage tool, especially in a year when we've already seen basis, historically strong. And so I do think moving forward, especially regionally speaking, there could be some areas where a person could almost write their own ticket whenever it comes to basis. We've been telling producers, who feel a little sheepish about shopping it around. I wouldn't feel sheepish at all, because some of these originators want to get their hands on your corn pretty badly. And so I give them an opportunity to do so.
I would make one observation that I did note, a processor here in the Midwest, looking at their cash prices all the way through the summer, it was starting to look inverted past July. So like Matt mentioned, where we already have strong basis now and you don't have a futures market doing anything, I think there is certainly a chance for basis to continue to be strong into the spring and summer marketing seasons. And it could get wild. I mean, that's not necessarily a reason not to practice good risk management or not to sell something if you need the cash flow, but just an observation that there is indications of some inverted strong demand summertime.
JP, the elevator system's has to be worried about this. I suspect they've been talking to you for some time.
Yeah, I think the elevator business is trying to figure out, they've got strong ownership, and we see strong basis at opportunities now. And so the question is, how long do you play that game? And are you, potentially going to be the one that's left on the wrong side if this thing turns?
It's now time for a final word from each of you. Let's start with you, Mike Zuzulo.
Well, in the spirit of the holiday, Todd, my Christmas music list this week has gone from I'm Getting Nothing for Christmas to Do You Hear What I Hear to Here Comes Santa Claus. So that's how I'm looking at this market right now for the corn producers especially. And in all seriousness, we have a very significant drought in Mexico. We have a wheat carry that has been erased in soft red wheat as December wheat gets ready to go off the board. It's actually inverted in premium. It's been a long time since we've seen that as far as an expiration. And so I think there's quite a few things happening that are potentially positive. We just got to get these trade deals done. If we don't get them done, it's going to go back to I'm Getting Nothing for Christmas.
Elaine Cubb?
Well, I'm embarrassed I can't think of any Brazilian Portuguese Christmas tunes to go along with Mike's theme. but that's really the thing that I'm watching right now is the currency problems, right? Like, we've got the dollar is interesting today just because there's a election going on in Britain. But mostly, I think the day-to-day direction of soybean prices in this entire month has been dictated by the Brazilian currency that has been rising. It's risen about 5% this month. So I would continue to watch that for the day-to-day direction of global soybean prices.
Matt Bennett?
Yeah, I think as you get into the end of the year, you just have to have some sort of a plan in place. There's a lot that can happen moving forward, and definitely want to spread my risk out as much as what I possibly can, because while I do feel like I said before, that this basis could get really interesting, I certainly don't want to put all my eggs in that basket.
And J.P. Jones.
Yeah, I echo Matt. I think you've got to have a plan. And I think, I've been encouraging guys to have a plan, not just for what they've got in their bins, but even more so what they're planning to do next year. Because I just see a storm coming with these trade agreements getting made, votes getting taken after the first of the year, and then quickly we start talking about acres for next year. And I just see, I just would hate to see guys not have some plans in place as that storm kind of comes in and we see where it all shakes out.
Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. You may find us and listen to us on demand, the whole of the program, anytime you'd like, at willag.org, willag.org. Our thanks go to our panelists this week, including Matt Bennett of agmarket.net out of Windsor, Illinois, Elaine Cubb from Ipswich, South Dakota, and Mastering the Grain Markets. You can find her at elainecubb.com. Mike Zuzlo is in Atchison, Kansas, and at globalanalytics.biz, and J.P. Jones is right here in Champaign County, Illinois, at INTL FC Stone. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.